This podcast is made possible by listeners who can contribute now at thestory.org and in collaboration by Burt's Bees, Red Hat, and the Redwoods Group Foundation, who believe by working together we can help strengthen communities for a better world.
A few days ago, Brian Nelson got word that he might have a chance to tell his story to a Senate subcommittee. For the very first time, senators are examining what it's like for prisoners who are forced to spend time in solitary confinement. Organizations like the ACLU and Amnesty International have said for years that solitary is inhumane and can destroy a prisoner's mental health. So when Brian got word he might have a chance to speak at the hearing, he was both excited and nervous. He's only been out of prison for 2 years.
I mean, it's some days I feel so alive out here, and then other days I guess so scared that I've just gone crazy. This is too good to be true. And it's, I spent roughly 23 years in solitary, and it's what I know.
Brian found out later that he will not be among those asked to speak to the senators, but he's here with his story. I'm Dick Gordon.
Support for the story comes from Goddard College, offering low residency education for adult learners since 1963, now offering both bachelor's and master's degrees in Port Townsend and Seattle, Washington. Learn more at goddard.edu. And the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org.
The story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It is co-produced by APM, American Public Media.
Coming up later this hour, someone who will tell you that all that divided attention that comes with multitasking is a good thing for your brain. First, though, a story of what happens when there is no such stimulation. When Brian Nelson was 16, an older man took him along on a revenge mission. Brian says he sat in the car while his friend went inside and killed a man. By the time the case went to trial, Brian was 17. He was tried as an adult, convicted of armed robbery and murder, and he served 28 years. He made a life for himself at a minimum security prison in New Mexico. His cell was mainly open. He worked as a tailor. He repaired the guards' uniforms and walked outside to the parking lot to put those uniforms in the cars. It was a tolerable way to do time. But one morning, back in 1998, everything changed.
And four U.S. Marshals walked in with automatic weapons and told me to lay on the floor. And they just started chaining me up. They drove me from Las Cruces to Santa Fe, the main prison in New Mexico, and then took me to the airport in Albuquerque and put me on a plane.
And did you have the opportunity to ask them what's going on? Where am I going?
Oh, I continually asked. Nobody knew. They just said they had orders to take me to the airport and put me on Conair, where it's all prisoners with U.S. Marshals. And it was a shock. I mean, I was a trustee. I walked in and out the prison carrying scissors, shears to do mend clothes and make clothes.
And car keys and everything.
Yes, and most of the time when I put the officers' uniforms back in their cars, there was rifles and guns in the trunk of their car, and if I was such a threat, I'm 15 minutes from Mexico.
Yeah, the point is you proved that you were trustworthy at that point.
Yes, yes. I mean, my cell door was maybe locked 2 hours a day, and that was just during count times. But other than that, I was free to roam in and out the prison at will.
All right, so where did this plane take you?
First it took me to Oklahoma City Federal Detention Center, and I stayed there for about 2 days, and I kept asking what's going on, and they're like, you're on a special transport going to TAMS. We landed in Greenville Airport in Greenville, Illinois, and everybody's looking out the window, and they're like, wow, what are all these police here for? And there had to be 75 Department of Corrections officers, apprehension officers, state police, riot officers in full gear, sharpshooters on the roof, and they were actually there for me and about six other guys, and they snatched us off the airplane. And the sad part is I was epileptic, and it's raining, and I started having a seizure, and instead of me getting medical attention, I was slammed on the ground, and they stood on my head until the seizure was over with. And all of it was on videotape. And this is our procedures. Welcome to TAMS.
And did you even know at that time what TAMS was, Brian?
We just heard that TAMS was being built. And at that time, it was just a minimum security work camp.
But wait a second. It wound up being this, like, supermax place where they said they were going to put the worst of the worst and stuff like that. That's what I've read about it.
Yes, there's actually two. The work camp is the one that cooks the food for the supermax. They do the laundry for the inmates in the supermax. There's a few guys, approximately 200 guys, in a minimum security facility at TAMS.
So you figured maybe you were going to the minimum security, similar to the kind of place you've been in New Mexico?
I was shocked. I couldn't think of nothing. I mean, everywhere I looked, they had rifles pointed at me, semi-automatic weapons. I mean, there were so many guns, and they had state police dogs just sitting there growling in our faces as I'm laying on the ground. Then when I was placed on the bus, they set a guy in front of me, and I'm in between two riot officers, and he's holding a gas canister. And if I spoke, he was ordered to gas me, and all the officers on the bus are wearing gas masks. Deputy Director Michael Neal came on the bus with several other officials in suits and said, "You're headed to TAM Supermax. If you say a word, you'll be gassed, and you will be there for 1 year."
That's crazy. That's like something from a movie.
It's worse than a movie because it was real. I mean, I'm here. I just had visits with my mom where I could walk outside the prison and barbecue with her. This was 2 days before all this. Now, I had so many chains and cuffs on me, and I mean, it's like these guys are just itching to shoot me. You know, and it's like, what did I do? I didn't catch no disciplinary report. I didn't get in any trouble, and all of a sudden, this is happening. When we arrived at TAMS, there was a gauntlet of more riot officers dressed up in orange crush suits, and they snatched me off the bus, dragged me in, throw me on the ground, and literally cut the clothes off me as I'm still chained up and leave me laying on the ground.
And still nobody was giving you any information as to why they brought you to this prison, right?
No. To this day, nobody's ever told me. I mean, there's been vague comments that they needed so many people there to make it work, that this was in retaliation for me filing lawsuits years earlier. In 1984, I had escaped from Stateville, and they're saying it might be retaliation for that. But the worst part was, the first time that it came up, the people, the counselor in internal affairs, asked me why I was in TAMS. And I'm looking at him like, what do you mean? You know, and it's, how am I supposed to tell you why I'm here? You're the one who snatched me with guns and dragged me to this place. And it was overwhelming. And I can't explain what it's like to have free freedom and where I'm working to get out to society. Doing everything I can to learn something, going to school, working as a tailor. I mean, I was able to go to church every day from like 7 in the morning till 9 at night. You know? And there may not have been priests or anybody there, but I could just walk in and use the chapel as I willed. My family could send me Christmas packages, you know, of food and stuff from home. And now all of a sudden I'm the worst of the worst and I'm some monster. And I think it was approximately, I don't know, maybe a week later that my mother had questioned people at TAMS, why is he there and why can't we have contact visits? And the psychologist lady actually told my mother, we cannot let him around you because he would kill you if he got near you right now. And my mom had a fit. She's a suburban white woman that's like, what? And it pissed her off so bad that she became a thorn in the prison side. You know, it's like, this is my son. We just hugged and kissed the other day. Now you're saying he'd kill me? It was propaganda.
Tell me a little bit about the cell where they kept you at TAMS.
The cell is maybe 8 foot by 6 foot, something like that. It's a big cell. The cell is completely gray. It's stark concrete. There's a window on the back wall that if you're 6'5", you might be able to get on your tippy toes and look out. There's a concrete little so-called desk that sticks out the wall. There's no chair in there. There's a stainless steel combination toilet sink, and that's it. And a concrete slab that you put your foam little mattress on.
They give you a radio?
No.
Television?
No.
Books?
for the first approximately 2 months I was there, I couldn't even have a Bible. They wouldn't give me anything. And I think I was there approximately 6 months before I was eligible to get a radio of my own. And I was fortunate that my mom could send me books because so many guys there don't even have reading material.
Did you have contact with other prisoners while you were there?
In a sense, I could stand in my door and scream. And that's the only way you could have contact. You just had to scream either through the door or through the venting system. Never was I allowed on a yard with them. Never was I allowed on a wing with them. Anytime one inmate moves, all the other inmates are stopped movements. You know, such as if I have to go to a hospital pass, anytime I move, I could be the only person in the tunnel, and I'm held by two riot officers, and I'm chained hand and foot.
This is a classic, then, definition of solitary confinement, right?
Yes. And when we first arrived there, they basically turned the lights off and told us we had to go to bed at 10 o'clock. And all electricity was turned off in the cells, and we weren't even allowed underwear. I mean, I went maybe 10 days before I was even allowed to have shoes.
Brian, have you come up with a way of trying to describe what that kind of life is like for someone who's never experienced it?
It's like living in a gray box or going in your bathroom and locking yourself in the bathroom for a weekend where somebody slides your food underneath the door to you. And enduring that for 12 years, and most people, when I tell them, just do it for a weekend, within a couple hours, they come out. They're like, I can't do this. You know, and I've had a few friends like, oh, I could do that. And they try and they can't. You know, I was like, how do you do that? You know, because they don't have their TV. I went approximately 11 years never seeing a TV. I had never seen a computer, cell phone. I had never driven a car.
Brian Nelson says the hardest thing for him was trying to maintain his sanity while he was locked in solitary. He was released 2 years ago, and we'll talk about this in a moment. He's still not sure how well he's doing. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In Washington today, a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee is holding its first ever hearing on solitary confinement. They're investigating the psychological impact of isolating prisoners in U.S. detention centers. Brian Nelson was an inmate at the Supermax prison in Tams, Illinois. He was locked in a cell, by himself, often 24 hours a day. Tams is a prison that's under scrutiny after inmates filed complaints of human rights violations. Brian works now to bring those to light. He's joining us from the Chicago Law Office, where he works as a paralegal.
The first 6 months, my wing was gassed approximately 3 times a month because there's inmates with mental health problems on the wing. He creates a problem. They come in with the riot squad. They gas him. It's central air, so the whole wing breathes in the gas. He's the only one taken out for a shower or medical attention. So all the rest of us that ain't did nothing wrong, we're stuck in a cell with all this gas. You know, and this was routine. Another thing you'd see is inmates getting stripped out and cutting on themselves. One guy cut his finger off. Another guy cut a testicle off. I had a friend there named Chris. He went on a visit with a friend, and they cried because his arm looked like train tracks. There was so much scars on it from just cutting on it.
And the people who did that, did they ever say to you why they did it?
They're going crazy. They couldn't handle it. I mean, you're in this cell. I was not disciplinary segregation. I was considered an honor inmate at TAMS even. And that's a weird thing to say that. I was supposed to have the most privileges of people at TAMS. And when I first arrived there, I was allowed 1 hour of yard per week, one shower per week for the first 90 days.
1 hour per week, not per day?
Per week, yes. After the first 90 days, it went up to 5 hours a yard and 2 showers per week. After 6 months, I was allowed yard for 1 hour every day and a shower five times a week. And then some of them, in what's called extended property reduction, they're naked in a cell for roughly 8 months. Each time they smart off to an officer, they knock them back down and they have to start over.
Was there a time there when you started to worry that your own isolation was starting to have an effect on your mental health?
Yes. And that started after about 3 months.
And what was the clue to you? I mean, if you're so isolated, you can't even talk to somebody about this, how can you measure how stable you are?
Because I never thought of suicide before in my life. And I actually started thinking about it there. And here it is. I had been locked up for 16 years before I even arrived to TAMS. And I had been in other programs where I was in solitary, but it was very different than TAMS. It wasn't a supermax. And I think I was at TAMS maybe 3 to 4 months before I had my first very serious suicidal thoughts.
And did you ever have access to a counselor or meds, anything like that?
About that time, something happened where mental health started coming and saying that I had to come out and talk to them. I was at TAMS approximately 6 to 8 months before they placed me on psychotropic medication. I had never been under psychiatric care ever in my life prior to TAMS.
And the medication that you were taking, was it just to basically stone you out to make it through a day, or was it something different?
It was a very strong antidepressant medication. It made things worse, because here it is, I'm thinking that I got to rely on medications to survive. I got to go talk to somebody. And when I went and talked to the mental health lady, she's telling me she doesn't know how to treat me because there's no courses about this. They had no idea how to help us. Even the psychiatrist that came to TAMS was like, I don't know how to do this, so we just try different medications, and if it doesn't work, we'll take you off for 2 weeks, and then we'll try something else.
What was it that finally led you to want to take part in a hunger strike there?
I read 10 Men Dead. And it's about Barry Sands and the Irish hunger strikers.
Yeah, I know the story.
And it was inspiration. We had a guy on our wing that did not speak any English. He had a heart problem. He took nitroglycerin. There was another Hispanic inmate that was a diabetic. There was no bilingual nurses in the prison. There was no bilingual inmate on the wing with them to translate when they were having a problem. We wanted shoes. We wanted underwear. We wanted education. You know, we didn't care about the food and all that stuff, you know, which most prisoners whine about. All of our demands were, treat us humanely.
And the other prisoners in TAMS, did they also know about the IRA prisoners, some of whom starved themselves to death?
Several of them I slipped little notes to, and the book got passed around. And then a few of us were able to talk with sign languages out of windows at the law library, little cages, and we formulated a little list of what we thought our demands should be. And none of our demands were for coddling us or anything. It's get bilingual nurses here, counselors here. Let us have shoes. The shoes they gave us, if I went on the yard and I ran for 5 minutes, the entire bottom of the shoe would be gone. And it would take me 90 days to get another pair of shoes. And we wanted underwear. I mean, why can't we have underwear? And it was just little basic things like that. And there was approximately 168 inmates in TAMS at the time. And I think everybody but four either declared the hunger strike or refused a meal the very first day on May 1st.
How long did you go without food?
It was approximately 43 days. I was hospitalized and they actually came to my cell talking about, you want a phone call to call your mother before you die? And I was like, no, that's okay. She's already fully aware of what's happening, and nice try, you know, because they were just trying to play with my head. They pulled stunts. They moved the last four of us on a wing by ourselves, and then they took like a food cart full of fried chicken, put it on the wing, and left it there. So the smell of it was supposed to make us want to eat. They played every psychological game they could trying to break us. And it was until they agreed to do some of the changes, we wouldn't come off.
And they eventually did make some changes, right?
They made half of them within the first 6 months. The rest of them were somewhat implemented over a period.
So it was 12 years you served there, right?
Yes.
And Brian, did you get any notice of the fact that your sentence was coming to an end, that you were going to be set free?
Oh, I knew that because I had a set sentence. I knew what my out date was. And the sad part is, for almost a year before my release, I started asking people, are you going to help me get ready for this? I mean, I haven't been around somebody, and I had went to a court hearing in East St. Louis with my attorneys, Alan Mills, from the Uptown People's Law Center here.
Yeah.
And the magistrate had them take the cuffs off me. And I was allowed to shake Alan's hand. You know, and I break out in a sweat. I'm nervous. This is the first human contact I've had. I mean, my hands are free. I'm being treated like a person again. And the young lady clerk, you know, they're all looking at me like, are you okay? Because I'm looking at a flat screen TV like, wow. I'm looking at a computer. It's like, this is a computer? And they're like, well, where you been, locked away in a cage? And I'm like, basically, yeah. I mean, everything was a shock to me. And prior to release, I begged them, help me get ready. And at this time, I was on four different types of psychotropic medication. I mean, they were knocking me out every night just to make me sleep.
Brian Nelson never did have a chance to acclimatize himself to life outside the prison before he was released. You're listening to the story. He says instead, he was put in a holding cell with no shower and no contact for 28 days. And then they let him go.
I was scared. When they take me out to the gates, they finally take the chains off. My mother's looking at me like, what'd they do to you? And my picture looks so different because I hadn't shaved in almost a month. And I just looked grubby for not being able to shower. And then I had always wanted a Blizzard. So my mom took me to a Dairy Queen or Tasty Freeze, whatever it was. And somebody walked behind me. And I lost it. I mean, I lost it. I panicked. Get away from me, you know, and I throw my back up against the wall. I'm thinking this guy's going to attack me. I mean, people are getting too close for me. And I just literally lost it. I mean, here it is. I'm used to having my own space, being in a cell by myself all the time. And then people are just walking where they're touching me. And it scared the shit out of me. I mean, that's the only way to put it.
I hope you got that Blizzard on that day.
Yeah, I got it. It's just, my mom and them try to keep me laughing in the car. I mean, they give me a cell phone, and I'm moving it from my mouth to my ear because I don't know how to work it, and they're giggling and laughing. And my sister's like, you know, she's on the other end of the phone, and it's sad, really, because I didn't even know how to talk on the phone. I gotta take a break.
There's no rush at this end.
Okay, I guess we're ready to go.
Are you good to go?
Yeah. Yes.
Brian, how long ago were you released from TAMS?
Be May 28th, I was transferred out of TAMS.
So it's been 2 years.
2 years, yes.
Yeah. And was there a point in that period when you began to think, I am going to be okay. I am going to make it. I've got the kind of strength of character that, you know, that I need to actually start helping other people by telling my story.
No, because I actually believe I've gone crazy, and this is just a dream, and I'm still in TAMS. I'm afraid I'm going to wake up, and I'm still there. And everybody looks at me when I say that. It's like, how do I know I just haven't lost my mind? I mean, some days I feel so alive out here, and then other days I get so scared that I've just gone crazy. This is too good to be true. And I've only known what it's like out here for 2 years. I spent roughly 23 years in solitary my entire prison time. And it's what I know. And I get family members, loved ones, they all tell me, you're not in prison no more, because I still sometimes think and act like a prisoner. You know, somebody asks you, what are you doing? I said, what, I got a check-in warden?
Huh.
You know, it's,
I know that one of the things, one of the tasks that you have set yourself, though, is telling the story so other people know what goes on behind those closed doors. And I wonder, you know, when you imagine the opportunities that you hope to have to speak to politicians, opportunities like this when we're talking and other people are listening in, what is it that people need to know and don't know?
We're human. We're human. Each time I talk about it, it knocks me back so far. But there's so many guys still going through it. And this is just one of the types of torture going on.
Torture. You use the word torture.
It's torture. No matter what anybody says, what they did to my brain. I mean, I don't understand what happened to me in that cell. I don't understand what that gray box did to my brain. Because, I mean, I scream at night over it. I don't scream about the beatings. I mean, the night terrors are real. And it's, you degenerate all through history. Every time there's been a study about solitary, it says the same thing. Either the guy's going to go so crazy, he's no use to society ever again. He's going to become suicidal, or he's just going to be a zombie.
So, Brian, I want you to do something for me if you can. I suspect that even after listening to what you've just told me, there may be one or two people listening to our conversation who are thinking to themselves, well, the guy committed a crime, and this was the punishment that he was given for committing the crime. And that's the way the system's supposed to work. How do you answer that?
One of the conditions of my parole answers that. They wanted me to have a reintegration evaluation. And if I didn't have that, they were going to send me back to TAMS. What they wanted to know, literally, from a doctor was, did this solitary confinement make me a homicidal maniac? This is what the Department of Corrections wanted, if I was going to come out here and kill a bunch of people from being in solitary for so long.
So the department itself was asking the question, if what they'd done to you had turned you into
crazy.
Yeah,
and this is written down in my parole requirements. And it's like, how could you do this to me, not give me a chance to be around a human being again, and then be so worried that I'm going to do this. And they just, what they want to do is make sure they're not liable for it.
Right.
That if I go out here and snap, oh, well, it's their fault because they didn't make sure and do some follow-up checking on me or anything. And then the other sad part is 95% of the guys in solitary confinement in the United States are coming home. Most of the guys in TAMS are coming home within 3 to 5 years. And now they're finally looking at it at a different perspective because there's so much attention coming to this.
So, Brian, just one more question, and it's this. You've got people around you who care about you and love you. You've got work with the law office. You're busy. You're doing important work. Although you say that there's times when you don't know if you're still in the gray box or not, are there also times when you think, I'm going to get through this?
It's when I was typing up my testimony, and I started a Sunday. And my girlfriend's sitting there, and she's like, why are you doing this? Because every so often I just start crying and have to walk away. And I was telling her, I'm trying to type it out of my head. And it's days where I walk into work, and I'm brain dead, and everybody goes, you okay? I was like, no, my brain's just not working today. You know, because it's stuck there. I call it my cell, my office is upstairs. I have an office about the size of my cell in TAMS,
right,
with no windows. I've been offered many different offices here with windows and whatever, and I don't want them. When I'm working with the guys, I want to be right there with them, you know, right back where I was, and I'm on my computer and I'm able to do the things that I couldn't do there to help change it.
You mean in a strange sort of way there's something comforting about that, the size of that space?
Yes, it is. And it's maybe a survivor's guilt because I'm out here and they're there, but I couldn't help them as much if I was still there.
Brian Nelson joined me from the Uptown People's Office in Chicago, Illinois. He works there now as a paralegal. Coming up next, Now You See It. Kathy Davidson is a teacher who believes that we worry too much about being scatterbrained or switching our attention from one task to another. She says the digital lives we lead now are forcing us to change. And maybe what we ought to do is embrace that change. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The mind is a frantic place. Even when we sit quietly, our thoughts flash around like a Twitter feed on speed. Images come rushing in as well. Kathy Davidson says that is the strength of our brain. In fact, she says it's this quality of our brains that will help us thrive in the digital age, because few people fit into the same mold of learning. Kathy teaches at Duke University, where she co-directs the PhD lab in digital knowledge, so this is her area of professional expertise. But much earlier on, she understood that people's brains work in different ways.
In Chicago schools, you could not graduate from eighth grade without memorizing the preamble to the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address. And I have what now we would call a learning disability, but I cannot memorize things. I just can't. And over and over and over, we'd be called upon to stand up in front of class, and pretty soon everybody else had passed in my class but me. I could not do it.
Was this humiliating for you, that you'd get to like four words in and freeze up, or what would happen?
It was even worse than that. I would defeat myself before I even began. I would simply know I didn't have it memorized. I would absolutely know I didn't have it memorized. I could paraphrase like crazy, but the requirement was we said exactly the words in exactly the order, and I just couldn't do it. And I was a rebellious kid, so
but you were a smart kid. You weren't a troublemaker.
I was a math geek, so I was a smart kid that way, and I could write. I was good at writing, so I knew I had some skills, but I did really badly in subjects that required rote memorization. And I convinced myself I didn't care. It wasn't that I couldn't do it. Huh. I just didn't care. And I had a really tough teacher. Her name was Miss Schmidt. I have no idea what comes between the Miss and the Schmidt, right? She was Miss Schmidt. She was really formidable. And she must have made me do it 50 times. And I was washing desks for lipping off because I was getting insolent, and all kinds of things happened. And then one day she said, how about if you go home tonight and write me an essay about the preamble to the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address? And she just had an intuition that I actually knew a lot about the subject. I just couldn't memorize those words.
So what happened?
I had this little notebook, and my grandmother actually kept it for many years, so I know this is true. It said a 100-page notebook, and I filled both sides with everything I knew and everything I could find from encyclopedias and what I had at home, what I had at home and at the library about the preamble.
All in that one night?
In one night. In my memory, I didn't go to sleep that night. I'm sure that's not true. But in my memory, it was a heroic Abraham Lincoln stays up all night and writes this. And what I didn't know was that that was unusual. So I handed this notebook to her the next morning. And here's this terrifying teacher who was looking through this notebook. And I have notably bad handwriting, so I'm sure she couldn't read it. But just seeing how much was in there and the amount of detail, she did this performance. She pulled out the certificate. We each had to have a certificate that she would sign saying that we'd done it. And in front of me, she signed the certificate saying that I had memorized those two things.
Even though she knew and you knew you hadn't. It was like...
Yeah. It was almost like not only did she know I hadn't memorized it, She wanted me to see that she was breaking a rule. This is not a teacher who broke rules.
Yeah, yeah.
She wanted me to see that there was some respect for me having spent that much time and energy and seriousness writing those essays, and that I wasn't just a troublemaker. I really couldn't, or for whatever reason, couldn't do the rote memorization. But she really, there was something, you know, for me it was very profound. Not only passing, because
I was scared.
I didn't think I'd ever pass eighth grade. But it was also seeing her bend a rule.
Yeah.
It was important.
When did you know, then, that you actually had a learning disability?
I was 27. I was already teaching at Michigan State University. I had my PhD 3 years. I had my PhD for 3 years. I got my PhD very, very young. And I was at a friend's house who had a daughter who was about 6 and a half, who was very smart. And people coincidentally said she looked like she could be my daughter. So I always bonded with Andrea. And her mom said to me, I'm taking Andrea in tomorrow to be tested for learning disabilities. I was like, learning disabilities? And she said, well, yeah, she has a hard time reading. I said, she reads just like me. She lies down and puts a cover over her head to read. And Linda.
This is Andrea's mother.
Andrea's mother said, why don't you come with us tomorrow? Just, you'll find it interesting. So I said, sure. And I went. And as I heard Andrea being diagnosed, it became clear that I read in a very unusual way. And so I stayed after and said, I would like to be tested. I know you test kids, but I'd like to be tested. And I guess it's a kind of a self, I don't know, some kind of funny, self-humiliating joke, but I always say it's the only test I ever got 100% on. I mean, I was way off the charts in terms of learning disabilities. I didn't know.
And does it have a name? Is it an ADD? Is it, what do you, how do you refer to it?
It's a kind of dyslexia, especially having to do with mapping, memorization.
Yeah.
Anything that has words and numbers together confuses me. So, for example, I've always known I can't write a check. If I have to write the amount of the check, like $2.49, as numbers, and then have to write it as words, I'll get it wrong about half of the time. And it's some confusion. I also was a singer for several years, but I would make up the words when I was standing on stage because I can't memorize words to music, except in languages I don't understand. So it's clearly some processing thing. I can sing Japanese, but I can't sing English. It's kind of funny.
But you teach people now about the brain, the way that the brain works. And one of the things that you say is that we're not supposed to be afraid of the kind of I was going to use the word assault, the way that all this stuff comes cascading down on us now from, you know, a digital world and an internet and a different way of working in the office and all the tools of communication that we have that terrify so many of us. Do you embrace these? Make them work for you?
You know what I embrace is I embrace introspection. And I know that sounds like it's not a real answer to the question of digital overload.
I'll let you
but
go
I
on.
Really believe that we have learned standardized ways of learning that don't suit us. And one thing the digital world makes clear is that we have really different learning styles. And instead of being freaked out by that, I think we need to embrace it and really think about what works for me. So, for example, when I read, I like to lie horizontally and I like to have a cover over my head. It's hard for me to concentrate, so I shut things out. When I read a book, I have no problem reading online, and you could probably drive a truck through my house, and it wouldn't be an issue. It has something to do with the color of the screen, the texture of the screen, and I've now taken all of these cognitive tests.
Right.
So I know there's tremendous subtle variations that we're not even aware of because we don't know what our own habits are.
Right.
When I do anything having to do with numbers, like bills, pay bills, I like to have a television on. I like to hear sound. And it somehow calms me down. But I've learned these tricks because I was learning disabled, and I had to learn tricks for myself that now also carry over into the digital age.
So my daughters are grown up now, but I was a crabby father of high school daughters because, you know, they're online and listening to music and doing their homework. And I'd come into their room after knocking and say, you can't do all those things and do your homework well. You have to shut it all down. Was I wrong?
It depends on your kids. One of your daughters might well have thrived that way, and that might turn out to be, when she doesn't have a dad around, the way she does her best work. Your other child, you might have been exactly right on. And the thing is that we don't even have names. We say learning disabilities. That's a very crude term for, in fact, hundreds of little subtle different ways that we learn. Some people learn best with a window. Some people learn best in a world where they don't have a window.
Well, how are we supposed to figure that out? Are we just supposed to let people adapt and find out what works for them?
I like to say that distraction is our friend.
Ooh.
That when any time we're feeling distracted, it's our brain telling us something isn't working. And if we can stop being irritated by that and stop and say, so what about my circumstance, my interest, my knowledge level, my office surroundings, yeah. the other media isn't working. That's a tremendous help to give us insights into stuff that we've spent our whole life believing isn't there.
So sometimes if I'm reading and there's a radio on, I don't hear it.
Yes.
And sometimes when I'm reading and the radio's on, I have to like find out where it is and go and turn it off. And I don't understand the difference between those two. Do you?
Sometimes it may well be what you're reading in one situation is so absorbing that you could have an earthquake and not know it.
Huh.
And in other times it might be that you're being compelled to read something that you really don't want to read, but you somehow have to read it. So in that second situation, because we know heartache and heartburn are the single biggest determinators of our attention. In other words, what moves our emotions and what governs our physicality, our body, how we hurt. Those are the things, far more distracting than email. Those are the things that really command our attention. So it may have been you were bored. So your ears were looking for something to keep themselves a little more interested than your mind had to be because it was your job or whatever. You wanted to pay attention to this book. You don't know until you really examine that individual situation. You don't know what the difference is. But even that you already know there's a difference means next time the radio's on and you can't read your book, you might pay attention in a different way.
I just think it's because I'm tired and I require too much energy to do one thing or
exactly.
another.
Right? Exactly. And we, you know, that's something we're terrible at schools. We have this idea since the 19th century that lessons had to be learned in these 50-minute chunks. Well, some kids are raring to go at the end of the 50 minutes. They're just getting started. Other kids are so tired, they won't learn anything. But we've tried to learn how to regulate the human body into standardized chunks that really only work for some of us some of the time.
So what's the fix from the regimented classroom that we're still a part of now?
I love the classrooms that are being more and more tailored to individual learning styles. And you can do this in all kinds of interesting ways.
An example of one, yeah.
I do this in the most low-tech way possible, either when I'm talking to huge audiences or in my own classes with 20 or 30 students. I'll come in the morning and pass out index cards, good old-fashioned paper index cards and pencils, and say, okay, 90 seconds, I want you to write down the three things you remember most from what you read last night. They write it down, and then I say, okay, now I want you to turn to somebody you didn't walk in with. Look at the things you have. You each have three things down. And talk together about the one thing you think is the most interesting and the most important on those two cards. And then I have them circle one thing. And that becomes the form of our discussion. But it also means if you're talking to somebody else about something you've already committed to writing, you're really controlling the dynamic of the classroom. You're controlling the dynamic of how you learn. You're also not just learning, you're teaching. You're having to explain to somebody why you wrote something
down. So
you're
saying it was a good thing to have it written down or a bad thing to have it written
down? If you don't write it down, students spend half their time negotiating the interpersonal.
Okay,
once you've taken care of that, once you actually have something written down that you have a stake in, it becomes not so much an ego matter as really trying to make your case. You have to argue your case. And you have to come up with something that's a consensus that you both come up with together. And the reason I shift partners all the time is so they don't get into dominant patterns and so forth. But it always works. And partly it's because people have different ways of explaining themselves, different ways of remembering, different ways of teaching one another. It's a very engaged way of teaching instead of me coming in and saying, here are the three most important things about what you read last night. I mean,
right.
It's...
And they write them down.
And they write them down and forget them as soon as the test is over. They've made an investment in what they've learned. And they're really interested in teaching somebody else, because they set up that structure, teaching somebody else why that was important to them. It's such a different method of teaching. And I try to do that in all my classes.
Now, you say... time and again that you're not an enemy of video games, that video games can be a good thing. And I don't remember hearing you or reading anything that you wrote that said, you play video games. Do you have any that you will sort of curl up with?
Oh, you're calling me out. I not only don't play video games, I can barely play any game. I mean, I'm from a family that loves bridge and loves Scrabble, and I kind of put my head down and walk in, and when I'm with my folks, I will play Scrabble. Bridge, they can't make me play, but I'll play Scrabble.
Right.
Because I'm kind. I really don't like doing... I'm not a game player.
But Super Mario and the Temple Run and all the water slide...
I love watching it over people's shoulders. I love the way people are entranced by it. Yeah. I love the way people learn by it, but it's as opaque to me as, let's say, bridge.
And so, the point that you're making is that we ought not to be as finger-waggy about the video games as we've become, right?
No, for people who learn by games, it's a phenomenally, phenomenally supportive way of learning, because what you learn in a video game is how to succeed by failing. You push yourself beyond your limit. That's how you level up.
Yeah.
And then you fail and you get to a lower level. And what that does is it doesn't say you're a failure out of this game. It says you're a failure. Try harder. Well, that's perfect. That motivational part is great.
For the mother of a 11-year-old boy who's listening going, he lives in his video game, Kathy, I got to get him detached. Are you saying that even with that kind of overexposure, the kid's actually doing something that's useful?
Well, there's two things. One, there's all kinds of perceptual reaction, memory, inference building, procedural things you do learn from games, even from some bad ones. But there are also great learning games that you can actually learn content from. Everything from, there's a wonderful, there are a number of wonderful games. I've seen one on algebra that kids do that teach you how to do algebra by challenge situations.
Right.
There's some marvelous games for people with learning disabilities, including things like social disabilities such as, and attention spectrum disorders such as autism. And in fact, I'm working with a group of people on a better game on autism that will help people learn how to read other people's emotions from their faces, which is something that's very hard for many people who have autism.
Right.
And it's a fun game. I mean, the main thing is, if a learning game isn't fun, it's not going to work. I mean, you know, like all learning, it has to motivate you. But that process of learning through trial and error and learning with and even competing with somebody else is a remarkably effective process that we use in all kinds of things. In fact, we use game structures for learning all kinds of ways outside the classroom. We tend not to use it as much in the classroom. But outside the classroom, you know, if your two-year-old starts to walk, you don't say, great, you've walked. You step back a little further. And you say, now walk here. And you put their favorite toy a little further. And you challenge them to walk. And that's basic. That's the basic structure of a game.
That's Kathy Davidson. Her latest book is called Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. And we have a link on our website at thestory.org. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Looking into the Eye of the Cheetah. Mary Wickstra has spent 10 years working with cheetahs in Kenya. She says we can all recognize the cat by the tear-stained mark that runs from its eye down to its jaw. But she says it's the deep amber color of the eye itself that's also bewitching.
I once read a quote that I have never found who the author of this quote is, but it says to look into the eyes of a cheetah shows a history unknown to man. And somehow those eyes seem to draw the people who tend to work with them, that it just kind of seems to cry out that we need your help.
Finding ways that the cheetah and the farmers in Kenya can coexist, that's tomorrow. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
So
Support for the story comes from Burt's Bees Natural Health and Beauty Care, on a mission to make people's lives better naturally for over 25 years. Burt'sBees.com. And Goddard College, offering low residency education for adult learners since 1963, now offering both bachelor's and master's degrees in Port Townsend and Seattle, Washington. Learn more at goddard.edu.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And this is APM, American Public Media.